This morning's public reading is coming from the Gospel of John, chapter 6. John's Gospel, chapter 6. John's Gospel, chapter 6. John's Gospel, chapter 6 and chapter 8 are my two favorite chapters in John, because Jesus engages with the audience. And the audience gets so flustered, they wanted to kill him on both occasions. Jesus just kept hammering the good news. And he doesn't even stop to apologize, knowing that they're getting angry and they're plotting to kill him. He doesn't even stop to apologize. He just keeps going. He just simply fires, boom, boom, boom. Chapter 6, chapter 8, for me, is like the Mount Everest of this particular gospel. All right, so let's dig in. I'm going to read publicly. You follow along. I'm going to pick up with verses 15 to 29. 15 to 29. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. And when even was now come, his disciples went down unto the sea, and entered into a ship, and went over the side towards Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus was not come to them. And the sea arose by reason of the great wind, and blew. So when they rowed about 5 or 20 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea, and drawing nigh unto the ship, and they were afraid. And he said unto them, It is I, be not afraid. Then they willingly received him into the ship, and immediately the ship was at the land whither they went. Most Christians read that without realizing they were some distance away from the shore. Now stop, think. And John, who was there, I wasn't, you weren't, he says, as soon as Jesus entered the ship, it was now on the shore. Talk about beam me up, Scotty. Boom. That's what it says. The day following, when the people which stood on the other side of the sea saw that there was none other boat there, save the one whereupon his disciples were entered, and that Jesus went not with his disciples unto the boat, but that his disciples were gone away alone. Howbeit, there came other boats from Tiberias nigh unto the place where they did eat bread, after that the Lord had given thanks. So the disciples are by themselves. Jesus is somewhere alone by himself, and he often did that in order to pray to his Father. Now the people who were fed by Jesus in chapter 5, they want a second helping of that free food. And they're looking. And so now they get in their little ships, their little boats, and now they're rowing across that lake trying to find Jesus. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, neither his disciples, they also took shipping and came to Capernaum seeking for Jesus. Now on the surface, this sounds good. Pastor, what's your grief? They're trying to seek Jesus. They're trying to find him. Is that not a good thing? Well, yes, it's a good thing, but it all depends what your motive. A lot of people today want Jesus. They want Jesus to make them wealthy. They want Jesus to cure them of all their diseases. They want Jesus to make their life easy. No concerns, no pain, just smooth ride to heaven. I want nothing to rock my boat. A lot of people want Jesus, but normally for the wrong motive. But here they are. And when they had found him on the other side of the sea, they said unto him, Rabbi, whence comest thou hither? When did you get here? Jesus answered and said unto them, Now watch, if you think that I was out to lunch a few moments ago. Verily, verily, I say unto you, you seek me not because you saw the miracles. Now the big miracle in chapter 5 was taking 5 loaves of bread and 2 dry fish and feeding roughly 15,000 people, which fought with several baskets of leftovers still there. But because you did eat the loaves and were filled. Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for the meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, for him had God the Father sealed. Then said they unto him, What shall we do that we might work the works of God? Now that sounds like a good question. What do we do then? Jesus answered and said unto them, this is the work of God, that ye believe on him whom he, the Father, had sent. Please be seated. Now, the rest of John chapter 6 is where this group of individuals and Jesus lock horns. All right? So in the weeks to follow, we'll be reading more of John 6, the part that I really enjoy. That's just the way I'm wired. But what's happening here? Well, Jesus did not believe in welfare. He fed these same people in chapter 5. They were there, his audience. He's on a mountainside. He's preaching all day. And then he turns to Philip in chapter 5 and says, hey, Philip, how much bread do we need to feed these people? Testing Philip. To test what his apostle Philip was going to respond to Jesus. Philip says, Lord, there's not enough money in our little treasury bag to feed such a people. And then Philip says, but we do have this lad, this boy, he has 5 loaves of bread and 2 dried fish, smoked dried fish. What's that among so many people? And Jesus just said, well, give me the basket. Give me the little lunch basket. And Jesus blessed it. I shared last week, and I'll share it with our visitors. There are 2 interpretations of how Jesus fed the 5,000. One of them comes from the New Age clowns, and the other one comes from liberal Christian theologians. Are you ready to hear what they say? The New Agers claim that the local yokels didn't realize that the white clouds up in the sky were spaceships, and when Jesus was praying, little green men were teleporting food from heaven. I heard that in the 70s. But what do the liberal theologians tell us, the ones who don't take the Bible serious? Maybe you haven't heard this. They teach other pastors to teach this to their churches. Everyone had a picnic basket. And everybody was greedy and selfish. But the little boy was willing to share his picnic basket with Jesus. And everybody got convicted and shared their picnic basket too. Is that your Jesus? He had to rely on the boy donating a lunch. Not my Jesus. I believe this was a miracle. Jesus even said, he told them what in that verse 26? Verily, verily, I say unto you, these are the same people in chapter 5 that he fed. Now they're coming back once again a day later because their tummies are on empty. I say unto you, ye seek me not because you saw the miracles. The feeding of the 5,000 to 15,000 wasn't really impressing you enough, but because you did eat of the loaves and were filled. Why do I say Jesus doesn't believe in welfare? When you read the rest of chapter 6, you know what Jesus doesn't do for the same people? He doesn't feed them a second time. Here's something for you. The welfare system is not even taught in the Old Testament. You know what one of the stipulations was for a farmer when he harvested his land, when it came to the homeless and the poor? Let's make believe that this second carpet is someone's land, and he's just got done harvesting. He was told that when he harvests, he was not to cut the harvest on the corners, but leave it for the homeless. This is Old Testament welfare. Unless the homeless got off their blessed assurance, they were told to go out into the field and pick their meal. The farmer was not to harvest and then lay it on the ground for them to simply come and snatch and go eat. The homeless and the poor were encouraged. You want to eat? Yeah. The farmer left you enough. Go out there and work the field. Did you know that? That's in the law of Moses. So the law of Moses in Jesus never advocated government-sponsored welfare. And it's the church's responsibility to take care of its own congregation, whether it's a widow or whether it's somebody is poor. That's why I am sick and tired of seeing all these mega churches, these so-called celebrity preachers who sit on billion-dollar enterprises. Today, we don't have pastors today. We have CEOs who are running a business. They're in the money-making business. That's what you not find here in the New Testament. You want to eat? Yes. Do your hands and feet work? Yes. Can you bend down? Yes. Get a job and then provide for your own. The ones who are truly in need, those who are truly handicapped, we take care of them. Either the church or some agency. But I'm saying that to be upfront. Old Testament welfare, the farmers were to leave standing crops on the corner of the property and let the poor feed themselves. Here, Jesus doesn't feed these people the second time. He doesn't. He tells them in verse 27, labor not for the meat which perisheth. He's making a reference to that lunch that he gave them the other day. That's only going to sustain you for one day. Do not labor for the food that's eventually going to go through your system and come out the backside. That's what he's saying. But for the meat or the food which endureth unto everlasting life. In the rest of John chapter 6, Jesus is going to present himself to the same audience of chapter 5 as what? I am the bread of heaven. He who eats of me, he who dines upon me, he who believes in me, he who puts total confidence and faith in me and me alone, I am your bread of life. Now, bread in the ancient world was not made like Wonder Bread today. Wonder Bread is nothing more but gut filler. Traditional ancient bread made by the ancients was hand ground. It was high in fiber. And if you didn't eat it today, it became a rock tomorrow and loaded with mold. There was no preservatives. That's why ancient bread was more healthier than Wonder Bread today. Just a side issue, free of charge. Jesus says of himself, I am the bread of life. He has no preservatives. He's the one that preserves us. He's the one that quenches my hunger. He's the one that quenches your thirst. He also says, I am the good shepherd. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Not only am I the bread of life, but I am that river of water. He who drinks of me, he told the woman at the well in John 4, will never come back to this literal well and draw from this well ever again. I will be your satisfaction. Is Christ your satisfaction? Or is it Christ plus something else? It must be Jesus only. And so he's telling them, don't labor for the food that's going to be in one moment and then it's going to fly out the other end in 24 hours. But labor for the meat that endures unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. He gives it freely. He paid the price. He bore the wrath of God. He took our place on Calvary's cross. Beloved, there is nothing that we can give or offer to Jesus that would ever cause Jesus to move on our own defense. He loves us unconditionally. But my dear friend, he's willing to give of this grace and mercy freely without price tag. That is why I reject outright any religion that tries to take Jesus and then tack on any human merit or contribution to what Jesus has already done. I was raised Roman Catholic when I was a rugrat. Not the Catholicism you see today, because my grandparents all came from Naples, Italy. I was raised old Latin Catholic religion, all in Latin, not English. And after my salvation at the age of 18, and I began to read the Bible for the very first time, I came to realize for the first 18 years of my life, all those nuns who were dressed up like penguins were lying to me. The priests were lying to me. The bishop and the cardinals were lying to me. And the clown in Rome with the funny hat, he was lying to me as well. That was an eye shocker and an eye opener to someone who was 18. To be lied to all those years. In verse 28, they said unto him, what shall we do that we might work the works of God? Now that sounds good. That sounds somewhat sincere. Well, Jesus gives them an answer. This is the work of God. This is the plan of redemption. This is the plan of salvation. He that believeth on him, on Christ, whom he has sent. Believe on the Son, whom the Father has graciously given and sent on our behalf. Now, in the next readings, we get further into chapter 6. My dear friends, the exchange between Jesus and these people gets hot, really hot. And I want to leave you with one side note, and hopefully this doesn't cause you to get too mad at me. But if you look at verse 15, after my salvation, I was taught that someday, Jesus came the first time in order to offer Israel a kingdom. But the nation of Israel messed up and rejected that kingdom when they killed him and had the Romans nail him. So that kingdom is on pause until down the road. Well, if Jesus came to be crowned king, we have a problem. What does verse 15 say? When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king. Did he take the crown? No. He walked away from it. So what I was taught 50 years ago doesn't square with my scripture. Sorry. Here's the grand moment. They got a crown. It's on the pillow. They're coming out to Jesus to crown him because he gives away free food. We like that kind of king. And when Christ saw the crown, he perceived what they were plotting to do. He walked away. You know why he walked away? In biblical Christianity, before you can put the crown on your head, you got to go to the cross. Modern religion is to hell with the cross. Give me the crown. I want status. I want prestige. I want position. I want wealth. I want to be something. Beloved, Jesus Christ now wears that crown in heaven as he sits at the Father's right hand. It was the Father who was going to coronate Jesus, not these puny people. Now, that might be a shocker for you hearing it for the first time. Jesus walked away from the crown because he has not yet gone to the cross. And the devil likes that. Who wants that old rugged cross? Who wants that blood-stained cross? The cross is a picture of death. It's a picture of humiliation. It's a picture of excruciating pain. Who needs the cross? Give me the crown. What was the devil's trick to Eve? Oh, God knows in the day that you eat of that fruit thereof, you will be just like God. You're going to be your own king. You're going to run your life, and no one can tell you how to run your life. That was the lie the devil gave to our first mother. Skip the cross, get the crown. Here's proof from this preacher out of God's word. When they did want to shove a crown on his head, Jesus walked away. Because the cross must come first. Well, may God choose to bless his word.